Okay, if everyone can find their seat, we'll get started with Stephanie, who is here. And you know not to take your mic up into the stands, because there'll be feedback.
Okay. I'll remember.
Okay.
All right.
Are we ready?
Sure. Can you guys hear me okay? All right, let's get started. So I wanted to just start by saying how glad we are to have all of you guys here. I know some of you guys have traveled from, you know, just down the street. We have some local people in the audience, and some of you have traveled from very far away, as far as Europe and even further. And we just really appreciate you guys taking the time to come and be with us and talk about software development, which is obviously something that we care very deeply about. So I'm going to be talking today about successful software project management. This is something that we're very passionate about as a division, as a group, as a team, and individually as well. Say, what we care about is we really care about making software teams successful across the board. We want to make people succeed. It's something that we have invested very deeply in here as a company. And when we look at software development today, it's something that's both, it's very, very fun, I think. For a lot of us, that's why we got into it. It's fun to build something new. It's really exciting to have a chance to shape the future of what's happening. It's also a very serious business for us. I mean, there are people in the audience, customers building MRI, ultrasound, airplanes, banking industry, government. I mean, these are all customers I've talked to either today or, you know, in the last 48 hours that we support on Visual Studio. Software today shapes so much of the world that we interact with. And so learning how to manage projects successfully, it's, you know, it's important. It's both fun and it's important for business as it goes forward. So what I'm going to talk about today is software project management, what works and what doesn't. And you know, I know a lot of you guys in the audience, and as you know, one of the things I like to do is be very transparent and honest. I'm going to talk about what's worked. I'm going to talk quite a bit about what hasn't worked. It's going to be a pretty open conversation. I thought a little bit about what I wanted to say. A couple weeks ago, I started kind of sitting down and shaping my thoughts. And I realized you know, I was asked to kind of talk about interactions between different processes, you know, when to use Agile, when to use other things, how to mix the two together. And I am going to talk about that quite a bit today, because I'm a big believer that there's a time and a place to be able to allow teams to choose their own process, and that not every process is fit for every situation. But as I sat and thought about it more, what I also realized is that there's a set of things that are common that make you successful in any project. And I sort of thought about the abstract, and you know, sometimes I try to be really careful and stay close to the abstract. But I'm going to deviate today a little bit. I'm going to cover the same things that we've talked about, but I'm also going to cover a little bit more. And the reason is because I really want you guys to walk away getting some value out of the presentation today, and just out of the conversation and your time here. So I'm going to talk about what we found that that makes software development work, both in my team. I'm going to talk about other teams I've looked at, and some of the companies I've had the luck and the sort of opportunity to interact with over the years. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the sort of when to use the right tool for the job. What's the library of options in front of you? Waterfall is my favorite. You'll hear me talk a lot about that. You should always plan everything up front. No, I'm kidding. That's a joke. So I'll talk about different options, and then I'm going to talk about coexistence, when you can allow teams to operate each with their own process, how to kind of create a structure to manage that, and when it's actually not appropriate to do that, when you're going to want to standardize. So let me go forward. And before I do that, I thought I'd just give a little introduction, which is, you know, something I've never done before. A lot of you guys know me already. You know, I sort of work on this campus. Sort of bricked in. I've been here for a long time, about 10 years. And I thought I'd just sort of briefly give a quick introduction. My name's Stephanie, by the way. I'm one of the GPMs here, the group program managers. I work on Team Foundation Server. And what many of you may not know is I actually grew up about 14 blocks away from here. That other green arrow is my house that I grew up in with my dog and my rabbit, which I used to release where about Building 41 is right now, because none of this campus used to exist. So as I kind of went through my life, I was told that I should go to work for Microsoft. So I, of course, went to the other end of the country. This is where I went to school. It's a very nice university called Brown, completely on the other side of the country. And I sort of stayed there and thought about going into academia. But what I found as I talked to them is they sort of wrote a lot of papers, and that was nice. And then other people read the papers, but they didn't seem to build anything. And I really thought building things was pretty fun. So I came back to Washington State And when I first got back from college, I went to work for a company called Aquantiv, which some of you may have heard of. They started quite small as an advertising company and grew over time to become one of the largest advertising companies. And I worked there for a couple of years and then came to Microsoft. I've been in Visual Studio most of the last 10 years. I came here because it was just a fantastic team full of what I describe as very smart and very nice people. Focused on providing the very best tools for software development. I've spent almost all of my career in Visual Studio, and the majority of it in this area of ALM. And sort of a funny story, of course, that after I moved from Aquantiv, Microsoft bought Aquantiv in the largest acquisition in our history. And, you know, if you really want to get funny, I now actually live six blocks away from where I grew up. So it's a funny story. You know, you sort of start in one place and you grow out. I'm a big fan of going out and seeing the world, but also sort of knowing where your roots are and coming back to the things you love. So that's just a little bit about me. And now I'll talk with you a little bit about kind of what we found has worked. So as I mentioned, you know, I started at Aquantiv, which was this other company. That when I was there, I think the average age was about 14, as far as I could tell. It was an internet startup. And the processes that they had were what I'd call not well developed. It was one of the things that made me most passionate about coming to Microsoft, because I thought, God, there's got to be a better way to do it than what we are doing right now. And so there is a set of things that I think are consistent that you can take away that run across all teams. And I'm going to sort of talk about lessons learned today. The number one thing I found, normally I'll do a top 10 list where I actually kind of count down to the biggest thing, but I wrote this deck and I thought, God, I just got to say this up front. I can't take it. The number one thing that I would list that you have to do is to get clean and stay clean, and this is debt. Many of you guys have seen me present this slide before. Some of you haven't. I'm going to talk about some new ways to think about debt. What you're looking at is the bugs that were on the 2005 release. And if you take a look at this, I don't know if you're close enough to see the numbers, but that top line is like 20,000, 25,000. It's a lot of bugs. And what you're looking at is a very, very, very steep burn down. And it wasn't just bugs. What was happening at that time is we did software development where you would do development, and then testing, integration testing was actually a separate phase. And then you would have a period where you did security. And then you would do, you know, kind of, it was all very sequentially based. And I was a PM. This is how it worked when I started. I thought, oh, okay, this is how it works. This must be right. But what you find is that as you defer work, that work grows. It's much like, as many of you know, debt in the financial sector, which hasn't been so good for us as a country. When you leave debt out to dry, it sort of compounds. And it's the same here. So we had just pushed an enormous amount of bug debt forward. And that meant a number of things for us. It meant that our end date was no longer predictable. Because when you fix one of those bugs, or when you fix 10,000 or 20,000 bugs, you're going to create a set of churn that makes it difficult for you to predict when you're going to converge. When we talked about deferring bug debt, it wasn't just bugs. It was also security work and performance, and for us, localization, because we localize in, you know, many, many languages, so you don't have to use Visual Studio in just English. And when you talk about trying to finish development and then turn the corner and put all those pieces together, it becomes very hard to predict how long it's going to take. And also, while you haven't been sort of, you know, you've been focused over here and not looking over here, some of these things may have interacted in a way that, you know, you didn't expect. In fact, that's pretty common. If you're not looking at something, it often you'll start to see failures. I call it the look under the kitchen sink phenomenon. You know, when you don't look under your kitchen sink, stuff starts to grow that's kind of black and not very good to look at. It's the same thing with software development. So get clean and stay clean. One of the things I wanted to point out is the real killer in this is that top line, that purple line. That's actually all bug debt. So one of the things you'll notice in the 2005 release is although we were burning down on bugs for beta 2, the total number of the bugs for the release was staying constant. Now you can just imagine what kind of load that creates. I remember this was my first cycle in Visual Studio, and the amount of pressure to just shut down and ship was enormous, which makes it really hard to make good decisions around finishing your feature, wrapping things up holistically. So I feel very, very strongly about debt. And I think that that's a principle, honestly, that should be applied to any project. So let me talk a little bit about what does work. And I'm going to talk about what we've done for Dev 10. I'm also going to talk about what we're doing now for Dev 11, because we've even improved since then. So the first thing I'd say you want to do is you want to stop and get clean. And this is something we do before we start any release now. We do a milestone, which is just dedicated to quality. For the Dev 10 release, before we started Dev 10, we did an MQ. The MQ focused on bug fixing, as you can imagine. It also focused on other types of debt. So we have a pretty large library of test automation. And what we did is we went ahead and fixed all our tests so that they're all working. Test case bugs, get all your test cases working, test infrastructure. So everything's clean when you start. The next thing I'll talk about is kind of staying clean then going forward. And this has been a huge investment for us in Dev 11, which is different than Dev 10. So this time we again did a milestone quality. But instead of focusing just on reducing debt, we focused on our infrastructure. Part of the reason we were able to do that is throughout Dev 10, we didn't carry as much debt. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what processes we used for that. But we did a bunch of things around just making the engineering process much more efficient. And I think this is very important for any company. So some things that we did, our branching and merging process. How many people here think branching and merging is painful? Just raise your hand. Okay, yeah. And those of you who didn't raise your hands are probably not branching. So the integration is really painful. And, you know, I talk to people who use GitHub and, you know, merging across, you know, just workspace to workspace. And like, okay, this fixes the problem. There's no tool in the world that is going to make branching and merging fundamentally unpainful. It is challenging to move code. The more code you're moving, the harder it gets. And so one of the big things that we did was to really harden our processes around branching and merging so that we have the goal is to be able to move code back and forth very rapidly between our branches. We look for often we'll merge at the end of every sprint and certainly at the end of every, I think it's end of every experience is when we do a merge. So that's roughly every 6 weeks. Every branch is exchanging code all the way up and down. And then we have a very, very disciplined set of practices. I'm going to go into this in more detail around what tests we run before we merge code. The branches we're merging into, we always keep them clean, constantly clean. In other words, they're always green, all builds working, all tests passing, so that you can rapidly do that code exchange. And then we also try and use a set of systems which help automate the merge. And it's this is all built on T Foundation Server, so it's the same system you guys have here today. Check-in validation is something that we've had since I started in Visual Studio, and if you are not using it right now, I actually had one guy who's a friend of mine and is in our MVP group. He says that he thinks it's the coolest feature in Dev 10. And it was funny. His reason was he says now he doesn't have to do all the checks for all the bad crap people were checking in before. It was taking up all of his time. What check-in validation does, I'm sure he has much better to I'm sure your developers in your company are much better and you don't have these problems that we have. What it does is essentially, before you check in, it will do a build. So it's verifying, okay, this code's going to build. And it's going to build not just, you know, on your machine, because we've all heard the thing, well, it works on my machine, right? It will also run whatever tests you want to run, unit tests. It can also run functional tests, so that's a UI test or different type of test automation. And also perform other actions you want, static analysis. And if it doesn't pass any verifications that you've defined, it will reject the check-in. And what you're doing with that is you're essentially making sure that your code branch is always clean. You're not checking in crap. You're not allowing people to make mistakes, whether it was through carelessness or honestly just accidentally. Something I'm very honest about, I have checked in. I have broken the Visual Studio build. And when you do that, there is a guy who comes to your office and he talks to you, and it's not a pleasant conversation. So, you know, we had been going around the check-in system that particular day, and that's maybe a story for lunch. But anyway, check-in validation, I think, is very important. And we've the same check-in validation system that you have with Visual Studio 2010, the gated system, is what we're using internally. And that itself is modeled on a process that we've been using for several years. So I'm a huge fan of gated check-in. Quality earlier in the cycle, and you know I'm going to go into this in a lot of depth, but essentially what I believe is that when you're doing development, you need to be doing your testing simultaneously. You need to be doing your static analysis simultaneously. If you're going to localize, you need to start looking at, you know, be running some sort of localized build as you're doing development. The more you postpone these things, you know, it's a lot like, it's just like getting a mortgage on your house. What do they call those, the ARM ones or the no interest? I can't remember the name of it. There's this type of mortgage they used to allow you to buy where you didn't pay down any of the principal. You just paid interest. This was not a good idea. And it's essentially the same thing with software development. That's just your debt is just compounding, and it becomes very expensive. So Quality as you go. This was something I wanted to kind of get into a little bit. Brian Harry has talked about this a bit in the past, and I just thought it was a really neat way to think about development, which is that testing is simultaneously. So your developers and your testers really should be sharing responsibility for the quality of what's coming out. This is how we operate now. When we do, when we build something, we do the testing at the same time. It was interesting. We'll do the testing for that area. So let's say you're building a new feature in Agile here. You would need to test, build it, and then you would need to run all of the tests for Agile. We also have you run a set of tests which test for everything in TFS. Like when you check in this Agile stuff, are you going to break anything in Team Foundation Server? One thing that I've been thinking a lot about over the last several weeks is how to improve when you're writing code that's really deeply integrated in some other area. And I've become a strong believer that you really need to think about the tests that test that feature you're integrating with, you need to be running before you check in. This is just an area I've been researching because I'm very interested in it. I've been talking with our team in India and here in North Carolina, and we're finding that this testing is really a critical part of being able to move forward successfully. Otherwise, when you check in, you're breaking six guys downstream, and you know it's nice that you were able to be productive, but you know up one, down by six is not getting ahead. I'm just going to talk a little bit about how some of our teams do the quality checks that they do as they go forward. And I'm going to show sprints, but you can do this really on any model. So let's say you have a sprint. The way our teams work is when they finish the sprint, and this is just in TFS, and I'm going to talk more about some other teams as I go. They are dev complete and test complete, so that means that testing has been done. Also means that all the automation is written. We do a fair amount of automation here because we have such a large matrix of operating systems and you know languages and so on, browsers, so many other things. All bugs are fixed. All the known bugs are checked in. So this isn't like, hey, you know, hey, I code this up and mostly works, and we'll fix that later. And we also do upgrade and setup at the same time. This is a big lesson learned from Dev 10, where we did upgrade at the end, and that also was expensive. Especially upgrade for us is very important. If you've bought TFS or any of our products, we don't want to punish you by making your upgrade painful. We want it to be the other way around. We want you to be excited to go to the next version and be glad that you bought the last version. So we actually do that right at the very beginning now. As you go on, when you are finished with, we usually try and finish a kind of what we call an experience, which is really kind of an end-to-end flow through a feature. And when you finish that, you merge it up. So you go ahead and run that merge process. Upgrade and setup again working, and we run a set of automated tests which span the whole product unit. That's where we do that testing there. Product unit here, it's you can think of it as if I want to check in a change on build, I have to run a slice of tests which cross all of Team Foundation Server so that I can ensure that I haven't broken you over here, and because otherwise it doesn't make sense for me to keep going. At that time, we also do several of the things that we don't postpone now to the end of the release. Again, when I started, we did this all, you know, hey, we'll do that later. Accessibility is a big requirement for us because we sell so much to the government. Localization, we do a set of builds where we will take a look at, it's almost like a worst-case localization. Localization tends to expand strings, and so we look at what it's going to look like when they're expanded and fix everything up ahead of time. Globalization, we do all the performance work then, something I'm sure many of you guys are sort of happy to hear about. We really want Visual Studio to be snappy. It's something where both want to make sure we don't regress it, and then we're making investments to even improve it over time, and then we do a usability check. So that's just a little bit about debt. I'm probably maybe even overly passionate about it, but it's something I feel really strongly about because I have lived through the experience of trying to recover from this. The big thing that I find is so painful about building up debt is that it's not just that you don't know where you are. It becomes really difficult to finish any one thing well because you sort of take on a whole bunch of things. You're about halfway done. And then as you try to converge, you actually start sort of slicing off chunks of all of them, meaning you know you have six features. You're ready to ship, and now you can't really finish any one because you're just trying to burn down through all the debt you've got left. It's much better to just do one thing, do it well, and then move on. Sort of same thing my dad taught me over on 142nd Street when I was 10. I've talked, you know, did this work? This is kind of a picture of the 2005 release. It's a picture of the 2008 release. It's just dramatically different in terms of the amount of debt that we carried going through that release. One thing that people often ask me is, okay, 2008 was a little bit of a smaller release for you guys. How does this compare to the 2010 release? So let me show you guys that. 2008 for us was a little less churn. 2010 was an enormous release for all of you who are using the new testing features, TFS. And you can see, again, a profile here of there was more churn with 2010, but just a dramatically different curve and a dramatically different experience to go through stabilization in 2010. So much more predictable, much more sort of a sense of being in control, understanding what the end game is, and being able to manage the release. So that's a little bit about debt. All right, the second thing I'm going to talk about that's, I think, an important principle is sort of open transparency. And let me talk a little bit about what doesn't work. One of my favorite things that doesn't work is what I call don't ask, don't tell. So this means my team has secrets. I'm not going to tell you where we are exactly in our schedule. I'm just going to say, we'll get there when we get there, and we'll kind of see how it goes. This often breeds something that at Microsoft, when I started, we used to call schedule chicken. Schedule chicken is, have you guys ever seen like pictures of two guys with a tractor and they sort of race at each other until one falls off? Or, you know, it's this concept of, you know, you sort of go head to head until one guy flinches. Schedule chicken is the same idea. It's, I think maybe I'm running a little bit behind, but I think you're probably running more behind than I am. So I'm just going to sit here and wait until you announce that you're late. And then I won't have to tell anybody that I'm behind. And again, has anybody else ever seen this phenomenon? Okay, all right. I just, you know, I'm being very open here. I just want to understand. Metrics are for others. So this is kind of the concept that all of your measurements will be internal, and you understand what they mean, but it's not really appropriate to tell anybody else exactly what they are, especially because that information could be used against you. And I've seen that too. Our tribe is better, of course, the last one as well. You know, my team, we really know how to do it, so I don't really need to know what you think. All of these things alive and well in teams outside of Microsoft, and certainly I had seen them when I started. So this is what I think really does work. Common metrics for measurement across all teams. One of the things that was really revolutionary for me when I came into what was called Team System at the time was that the team was open and transparent about how everything was going. And what that meant was there was a common set of bug metrics that was used for every team, how the teams were progressing. And so I could look at any given team at any time and see exactly how it's doing. And I'm actually just going to jump to the bottom bullet here. The biggest thing that builds that I think is really useful is peer pressure. Is if you are transparent with a common set of metrics, that means everybody knows how you're doing. And that can be good or that can be very bad, depending on how you're doing. But what it means is no longer is there just a single manager who's responsible for trying to understand how people are doing and trying to push them and make it fair, and it's this sort of secret process. It's very open. Like, you're behind. And, you know, maybe you look again in a week, and you're still behind. Maybe you're still behind on week 3. I'm going to show you some pretty funny mail chains where you see sort of the same team on top week over week. It starts to build a fair amount of pressure. An open and clear cadence of communication. So if you've got these metrics, then just sending them out. You know, you just once a week, you send a mail. Again, I'm going to show you guys kind of a funny example of a regular mail that we sent through 2010, and we had the same team on the top of the mail for a couple of weeks, and, you know, that seat starts to get pretty hot. And common understanding of the problem. So you shift through the release, as you look at these metrics, it starts to tell you what your problems are. Is it testing? Is it bugs? And having kind of a, all right, this is where we're all going to focus, and we're going to fix this one thing. So this is the scorecard that I talked about. So this was something that we would get sent out to us weekly through Dev10. And I've erased every team except TFS. I don't want you guys to go picking on teams. But, you know, you can pick on us because I'm here and that's fine. And you can see at the time that we got this sent out, let's see, how were we doing? Bugs per person. We were doing okay, but we weren't doing great. And let's pick on something we're bad. Dog food usage, 31%. So we're actually tracking how many people had installed the product. At that point, I can't remember. I think we actually had a reporting error where they weren't picking up everybody in North Carolina. But, you know, the next week, Brian sent out some mail, and we had this all fixed. We were not at that position on the stack. The one thing I can tell you, I'm not going to tell you who was the team at the top of the stack, but I will tell you that for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, it was the same team. And it got to the point where, you know, I wasn't even in the same building as that team, but I was kind of like, man, what's going on over there? And that kind of peer pressure, it really builds and inspires people to to transform what they're doing. All these metrics are, most of them are drawn from Team Foundation Server. Most of them you can get out in, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes. I'm going to show you building automated reports. It's not hard. Some of them we generated, like dog food usage. We use internal tools to track. But none of this is with a central tool like TFS that allows you to automatically gather data and then pull it out of a system with something as simple as Excel. This is not a hard problem if you've got an email system and a and a regular, somebody who's sort of driving a regular cadence. Development progress. This is another real graph from Dev 10. This is maybe a year and a half old. You guys, if you have used TFS a lot, you're going to recognize some of the features up there on the screen. And this is just a report that we pulled out, and you can take a look at it. Can look at every team on the graph. What it's showing you here is red is work that's not complete, dark green is complete, and the light green is new hours reported in the last week. So you look at this, and a couple things jump out at you. Huh, there's a couple teams there that don't have any light green. What are those guys doing? And so you get together once a week, and you kind of say, well, what are you guys doing? A couple other things that stand out. There's some teams up there that have a lot of hours, and maybe they're not progressing. And so each week, you just start asking, like, how are you guys doing? How are you guys doing? It's just a common set of metrics to be able to have a conversation. This is built on top of TFS again, and it's really just using the task roll-up under a feature work item. We happen to be calling it feature at the time. We have user stories in what we ship. And you can see people could also mark themselves as at risk. So we had a couple things at risk, handle display name change. And then you can just have a conversation like, okay, how's that going? And just a common set of metrics to track. Very, very useful. Value propositions. This was a chart. How many of you guys have seen this one before? Okay, nobody. All right. So let me just explain what this is doing. Let's say you got an individual developer. So let's say you right here, you're an individual developer. So you check in. And when you check in, TFS has you resolve your task. Great. So that's all you did. You checked in. Meanwhile, over here, let's say you're, these guys over here, they're working on your team, and you're trying to figure out how much work is going in on each of the major initiatives, because you have to go talk to your boss, the CEO, and explain, this is how much we're investing and how far we're doing. So he checks in. That information automatically rolls up, and what you're seeing here is a roll-up through the system that's showing you the major things we were investing in 2010, how much work was done, and what was left to complete. So you can see exactly what we were doing. For instance, the three major initiatives, business alignment, so enabling people to align their businesses with what customers want, reducing blockers and dissatisfiers, we always make huge investments in that, and then testing, which is really having a fantastic set of tools to build a quality release. You guys saw very big investments there. One thing that's really interesting, take a look at that designers. It's like running off the edge of the screen. Cameron Skinner, I know, came and spoke with you guys earlier. That was Cameron's team. They had looked at UML diagramming, and they said, we really need to invest in UML. We need to comprehensively overhaul what we're doing and build a great set of designers there. And you can see all that work rolling up. It was exactly the right investment. But this type of view allows you to see, okay, where am I investing? How am I doing? What's left to do? And it's just, again, you just checked in and marked your task complete. That's all you did. So, testing. This is this type of graph has been at Microsoft as long as I've been here, and it's just a very useful way of looking at how your testing is progressing over time. So, what tests are passing, what's fair, what's not passing, and you can look at this for every scenario, for every team. Very useful way of looking at metrics. Keep going. Automated exit criteria. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but we also track for each. For each milestone that we're exiting, we track whether teams have marked off everything. And again, it's just they put the information in TFS, and we automatically get a grid out like this, and you can drill in. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I want to show you guys some real examples. So I said I'd show you guys some funny mail. So here's some funny mail for you. I think I blacked out the team names. We're going to find out in a minute. I checked this morning. I was like, oh, this is going to be more transparency than I meant. So here's some mail. You can see this is going to Visual Studio Drive, so that's every person in leadership in my area. And this is a nice graph that's showing everybody how they're doing. And I'm just going to tell you there was a nice team right here. And you can see this guy. He's, of course, very clever. Jeff Beeler is just honestly a genius at project management. A lot of what I've learned has been from watching Jeff. Jeff has this really graceful way. He just takes the next week. He just replies right on top of the same mail. Just going to tell you guys, same team was right here. You're taking a look at this and their teams, and it's, at some point, you start to ask questions like, is this team going to be able to ship? Should we sit down and have a load balancing conversation with these guys? Do they need more people? Do they need to cut some features? And all of a sudden, it's no longer this sort of private discussion. It's no longer, you know, a case where I'm just kind of waiting for them to slip. We're having an open and honest conversation about how they're doing with a common, fair set of metrics. And this team eventually was load balanced. They did get some help, and we did ship. Let me show you another example. This is just some more examples. You'll notice a lot of these are coming from Jeff, as I mentioned. He's very, very good at this. So this is just another graph showing you all bugs across all teams. You can see kind of the breakdown here. Again, bugs per person, very interesting metric to track. And then showing all active bugs for the release. So you can kind of see this was an interesting one because it showed us, although we were burning down on beta 1, we were pushing a lot of debt to beta 2. So that's kind of a problem you got to get on top of right away. So common set of metrics. And then this is another metric we like to track is what's your incoming rate. Because if your bugs are going down but your incoming rate is, you know, still pretty high, you're probably not stabilized. I think those are very good metrics no matter what project management you are using. I thought I'd show you guys just a little bit of some of the dashboards, some of the dashboards that we use. Let me see if I can get out of here. Let me just ask you, as an audience, are you interested in these kind of like real world examples, or do you want me to talk more about theory? Real world examples, yes? It's okay? Okay. I'm going to keep going with some of these then. I'm using mostly internal because I don't have, permission to show you stuff from other companies, but I'm generally talking about a set of practices that I've seen work in other of our customers as well. So this is a real dashboard. It's up to date from this morning. I just hit refresh on my way over here. I've scrolled down a little bit because there's some stuff up above the fold that you probably shouldn't see. But what you're looking at is this is live access to TFS. This is just using the same dashboards that we shipped in 2010. Those dashboards will automatically configure for you web parts that have live web access, so I can open this up. This is the TFS work item. I can't really remember which team I'm looking at, so we'll see. I'm not going to edit this because I'd be actually changing working stuff. We'll edit it, but then we'll delete it because that would be bad. And then these reports right here are just like you'll find in your own 2010. These are just Excel. So let's take a look at their task burnout. So you can customize these however you want. This particular one, they've taken the same one that ships out of the box, and you can see they've rearranged the web parts on their page to get, you know, what they like. But you could open this up in Excel, customize it, and save it back, and it's as simple as that to customize the dashboard. So very, very quick and easy for teams to get an understanding of how they're doing. And I think that's almost more important. It's great to have metrics at a leadership level. It's a lot more valuable for the guys who are actually doing the work to know where their problems are. So, all right. And then self-service reporting in Excel was the last demo I wanted to show. This is just one more feature in the 2010 release. So many of you guys may have generated reports in Excel, and I'm not sure if you'll have seen this before, but what I'm doing is taking a query. It's just a query that's in TFS of all the user stories that we're working on right now. I'm not going to show you the names because then you'll know everything about Dev 11. Hopefully I can still surprise you a little bit later on. But what this is going to do is it's automatically setting up a connection to the warehouse. It's configuring the connection in the report based just on the query and the columns I had in the query. And it's going to generate for me a report like those ones I had on the dashboard or the ones that you saw Jeff sending out. We just got a nice email from Jeff about a week ago saying, I finally had a chance to use this feature, and it really is as cool as you guys said. So that was very, very nice. You could do this manually if you would like. Probably takes about an hour to set it up. The nice thing is now this takes me, I don't know, I think that was about 45 seconds. So this is giving me, what you can see is here's all the work items we've got right now. We still have a bunch proposed, some completed, and then a slice here in progress. This is also a big thing that I believe in. I think Cameron will have talked to you guys about this. We're really believers in not having everything in progress at the same time. The trend reports are the nicest ones because if you've ever tried to configure this, it takes a little while to get the date access right. Let me show you the one that's really cool here, which is the state trend. So you can see here, here is all the work items we've got in the system, all the user stories, and you can see we're kind of trending towards completion. And once you've built this, it's really easy to customize. So let's just drill in on one team. Oh, that's faster than I expected, going over the network and connecting from, wow, that's pretty quick. So this is just for the set of agile investments that we're making. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this, but you can see that team is kind of progressing nicely towards their goals. So that's pretty cool. These reports, because it's just Excel and we integrate with SharePoint, I could take this and publish it up to the dashboard, and then it'll automatically refresh. So it's about that easy to do reporting, pretty easy to keep track of how your team's doing. And that's really the goal with everything we build in TFS and in Visual Studio in general. You know, the goal is just to make you guys successful doing software projects. It's really hard. It's really fun. But we just want to build the very best tools that we can. So clear vision. Okay, so this is the next thing I thought I'd talk about. And this is based a little bit off some of the things that I learned when we were planning Dev 11. So it's actually a little different than what I've said in the past because I learned some new stuff. Continuous customer connection. One of the things I think that's most important as you're doing project management is there's not really a period where you sit down and say, all right, we're just going to think about the vision and we're going to figure it all out. You know, I've got a week and I'm going to get it all in my head. If you're talking to customers all the time, you start to build up a concept of here's the set of big things that we need to fix. And, you know, here's the set of things that might be less important. And you want to be sort of building that continuously. What's a good example of, you know, like Team Foundation Server. What's one of the top of the list that people talk to me about? Version paper cuts in the version control system. You know, people have a long list of stuff that they would like to see us fix in version control. And I could, you know, kind of name a couple of them off the top of the list. It's probably the same ones that you already know. I don't want to wait until we're planning to figure out what those are. Setting the release priorities at a high level, I think, is very, very important. Because if you don't, what you'll get is each feature gets just a little bit better. And that's not really what you want. You want to say, all right, these are the big two, three, four things that we're going to invest in. And we're going to focus all of our efforts around that. And this is kind of where it gets a little bit new, because these are my learnings from the last 6 months. One of the things that we did in this release is we did something we haven't done before, which is we just set up a period of time where we said, okay, we're not going to try and determine what we're building. We're just going to wallow in information. So we looked at the competitive space. We looked at what was going on just in the industry with sort of developments in web development, technology, what was new that was coming, what was exciting, what ideas we had. We just explored them for a couple of months. You know, what was happening in Microsoft technologies. And this is something that I've seen work really well in other teams as well in our competition. In our customers, they'll take the time to understand what they're building and really just go deep in the information. And we did a lot of we'll have one person go off and look at operate sort of an area, and then we'd have them come back and present. And they'd present to really the whole team. Everybody was invited. The idea is you're just kind of wallowing in that information, and out of that, certain ideas start to kind of take shape. And that kind of gets to my second point, which is to include the entire team in the planning process. This is a kind of a big transformation for me. I used to really think you wanted to focus planning on kind of this core set of people who were going to get it done. And I think I've really learned a better way, which is one of the core tenets of Agile that I've seen be very successful is having the entire team have a deep understanding of the customer problem and what you're trying to build. And that helps whether you're doing the UX design all the way down to testing. And so we're now very inclusive right from the beginning. So from the very point where we're saying, you know, web technologies, web 2.0, this is or web 3.0, wherever we are, this is some of the really cool new things that we've seen coming. And this is how, you know, we don't know yet how we could integrate it, but look at what you can do here. And, you know, let's just kind of talk about some ideas. And we now include everybody in that discussion so that everybody can kind of get their ideas churning. And when you get to the point later on where you start to kind of focus down on what you're going to build, it's very useful. Building common understanding, and then as you go forward, kind of progressively narrowing focus, it's very useful. Organizing around scenarios is another thing we found is quite helpful in vision. So this is just a quick look at for Dev 11, and I've seen this in other customers as well and how we do it. Just focusing your work around what is the scenario you want to build as opposed to here's the point feature. So instead of saying, you know, I want spell check in Word, I want people to be able to use Word and have it provide correct information at the end. So I might want spell checking and grammar and these other features as well. This is just some idea of the scale that we have. A lot of this stuff is probably as much as you need to know. So I thought I'd just give you guys a brief snapshot. I'm going to show you a few things that the marketing team has told me I'm allowed to show you. So as we do our envisioning, one of the things then we start to do is we usually will build some storyboards. What we have found is a lot of people's approach to requirements originally was kind of like, I'm going to write these down, and then if anything at all changes, I'm going to punish you for it. It's like, don't change anything. In fact, what we found is much more valuable is coming to a common understanding of what it is that you want to build, and that means the entire team. Now, this is not to say that there's not a place for a very formal capture of requirements, where once you have that common understanding, you're going to need to manage them very closely, especially around banking, aerospace, industries where you know, what you're building has a very high degree of precision. But I'm going to show you guys. I'm going to show you guys some stuff that I'm not going to put in the slides you take home. This is just to take a look at some of the storyboards that we have for Dev 11. As you have probably already gathered from the many talks about Agile, we feel very passionately that there's a lot of fundamental goodness here for helping teams build software better. One of the things that we've gotten a lot of questions about is when is TFS going to build a task board? When are you going to build a task board? And we really, I'm not going to talk about our entire Agile vision today because that's certainly out of scope and this is not about Dev 11. But I do want to just give you a flavor of the type of things we're thinking about building. This was an early vision that we built of what a task board might look like. You can see it sort of starts to capture a lot of the things we were getting very excited about, really kind of webby look and feel. Things like personalizing, showing people, showing data right on the grid, like a burn down right there, being able to do things like drag and drop. Concept of team, being able to do things like, oh, you know, automatically show me all the stuff that's blocked because I've got all this information in TFS. Pivot, I want to look at my stuff by team member. And, you know, people started to kind of come up with different ideas as they played with this idea. Being able to see where you are in the sprint, so clearly having a concept of time in the system. So that's just kind of a quick glance at some of the ideas we had. I'm showing you about four slides out of probably 300 that are parked back in my office. But we find that this type of visualization really helps get people rallied around an idea and clear about what they're going to do. And, you know, we're also very excited about the task board, but that's for another day. Let me switch back. Okay. Customer-driven design. I'm going to talk very briefly about this. This is, as you're thinking about design, there's basically, I consider design part of project management because as you're thinking about what to build, that really ends up shaping sort of how the project goes. I really think about a structure that's very simple. First, understand your market, understand your customer. Those come first. Then try and figure out what problem it is you're trying to solve. I see this all the time with interviews. I'll ask a candidate a question, and they come in and they start talking. If I ever interview you, by the way, this is sort of what I'm looking for you, so I'm sure I never will for most of you, but they'll come in and I'll say, I want you to do this, and they go straight to designing. They're like, okay, I want this box on the form, and it's going to be here, and this button's going to be red. And I'm trying to get them to step back and think about, okay, who's the customer you're building this for? What are the core problems you're trying to solve? Because usually once you understand the problem, you can develop a range of options. And this is, of course, the neat thing about software. There's not one way to do it. And I'll often look to see if people are able to be objective about the potential options for what they're doing and weigh the pros and cons. You know, this has this advantage. This would be more performant. This is more usable, blah, blah, blah. And then as they build that up, then kind of narrow down to which of those options is really the very, very best. And that comes back to that continuous customer connection. Then you choose. And then, of course, always be open to new information as you go. Thoughtful schedules. So this is now I'm just going to talk about a couple of different practices, and I'll go sort of quickly through this material. Just some common sense things we found works. Break work into manageable chunks, so don't try and sort of, if you have a piece of work that's very, very large, it becomes hard to understand and estimate. So whether you're estimating hours or whether you're working in sprints or in sort of more of a feature-driven model with milestones, try to break the work down. We have found over time all of our iterations are successively getting shorter with each release. Create buy-in as an organization. A schedule is really designed to help focus people on a goal. If I build a schedule and I tell you, what product do you work on? What are you building right now? You must be building something.
Windows app.
What's that?
Windows app.
Okay, Windows app. And what's it for?
Quality measurement of the air.
Quality measurement of the air. If I told you you're going to ship in 7 months, would you believe me? Okay. Maybe I got a lucky guess. But the idea is, you know, if I just kind of provide some schedule top down, in this lucky, very unusual case. It seems to have worked. But for the most part, you have to have buy-in from the organization. People need to understand what that schedule is based on. They need to believe in the dates and sort of the work to get there. And so a schedule without buy-in, really people won't work to it, they won't drive to it, and it's not valuable. So, and that really kind of gets to a second point, which is you want to do scheduling bottom-up. So let me just ask you a couple. I'm sorry I'm picking on you, but you're close by. So tell me, what's one chunk of work that you have to finish before you ship?
Make sure that the user at least accepts what we've built, what they expected.
Okay, and how long do you think that might take?
2 months,
okay. And then are there any other types of testing that you might need to do?
Unit testing.
Unit testing, yep.
Performance testing.
Sure. And I mean, I'm sure I won't force you to sort of go into all the details of what you're doing, but you kind of get the idea. As we build schedules, we actually have a very rigorous process for building them bottom up, where we expand out and look at all the work that's there, and we sort of lay it out and figure out what it's going to take to finish it, and only then do we say, all right, this is what we think our schedule is. Now, we do this closer to the end. We don't do it now because it would be impossible for us to say. But as we get close to any public release that you see, a beta, certainly RTM, we're doing very, very rigorous bottom-up scheduling, and that does two things. One, it helps us understand what is all the work left. It's sort of a process of, like, beating the bushes, and you want to do a lot of bush beating for things that you don't know about. Second, if I understand where that schedule came from, I'm much more likely to believe it and work to it. So thank you very much for letting me talk to you. Making commitments. Schedules are very valuable. It is valuable to say, I'm going to have this done by this time. So I think schedules are valuable in that way. They do create forcing functions. And if there is a time to cut, a time to converge in a release. So I do believe there is a time to set an end date and say, all right, this is what we're working to as a release. And I believe that meshes whether you're working with a more formal process methodology or a more agile one. There comes a time to say, we're not going to put new features in. We're going to converge and ship. This is probably my favorite. Don't trade one bad schedule for another. Is there anybody in the audience who has ever built a schedule and had it be wrong? Yes. I am sure most of us who work in software have seen this happen. And my most unfavorite thing is you see the schedule, it's unrealistic, and of course everybody knows this, so there's a lot of tension. So then you get another schedule, and it's different, but you can see it's not any better than the last one. So I'm a big fan of don't trade one bad schedule for another. Wait, really do the bottom-up exercise. It's better to wait and say we're not really sure where we are, but we're going to find out. And then say, all right, this is a realistic date that we're going to march to. This is something I've seen Visual Studio do successfully several times. It's certainly something that the best project managers do. Different tactics for different phases of the release. This is, again, sort of one of my favorites. I'll spend a little more time here, and then we'll start to look at wrapping up because after this is lunch, and lunch is very important. So the middle game, I think it's important to realize, one of the things I've learned is that there's actually different effective tactics at different times in the cycle. The middle game is very different from the end game, and I consider the middle game sort of, you know, when you're very much in development, you're actively working through problems. The thing that's challenging about the middle game is there's sort of a lot of uncertainty about what you're going to build. You haven't really defined the shape of the release because it's still expanding. There's a lot of churn. There's often you're still sort of deciding exactly what's going to be in there. And you can often sort of get paralyzed. You're still in this phase of like, well, okay, this is what we could build. It could be so cool, and it's so big. And you haven't made the transition to let go of whatever it is that you're going to need to cut to get there. And I've never seen a software release where you don't have to make painful cuts. I think one of the most difficult things is when people fail to make this transition. They don't make cuts early enough, and so they end up going in with a very unrealistic idea of what they're going to build. As a result, you get, you know, a quarter of the way through everything, and it's quite demoralizing. So one of the ways, how do you survive the middle game? And this is, again, you know, I have to thank Jeff Beeler for some of the ideas here. Real code is just enormously helpful. As you build each thing, you know, have a demo, show it out, share it out. Having mini milestones where you have constant mini goals. This is what we're going to complete. This is what's going to be working. It's very different than saying, you know, hey, we're going to build all this and it's going to be so great. I'm like, yes, it's going to be all so great, but it's probably only going to be this much. As you start to build, you start to really understand what your velocity is through concrete deliverables, and that allows you to internalize what your real end point is. even better than that, it's not just that, you know, I've internalized it as somebody in leadership or as a developer, but your entire team is starting to kind of get a sense of, okay, this is what's possible. Build frequently, integrate, and then be updating customers. If you have a customer drop of some kind, that's a tremendous forcing function. If something's not working, you're going to need to get it working, and that will start to kind of cause you to converge. In development, what we found is there's these constant cycles of sort of going wide and then converging and going wide and converging. And it's important to do both, to have that period where you wallow in information and then also have a period where you converge and say, all right, this is what I'm going to do and what's working. And doing too much sort of like blue sky results in, you know, projects that never ship. And too much convergence, you don't really get a chance to develop those exciting ideas. So it's important that they exist in tension. Let me talk a little bit about the end game. The end game is very interesting. This is where you start to get to the point where you're releasing. Things are going out the door. Even in very short cycles, like Bing releases very, very frequently, even they have kind of a concept of a middle game and then a little bit of an end game. And in a longer release, it's, of course, that time is just expanded. As you start to get towards the end game, you want to think about activities that start to slow down the churn on the release. So you want to start raising your level of testing, which expands across all areas. You want to do things that are going to start to manage and slow down that churn. So we do internally, we'll do what we call a full test pass, where we run every test that we have on the entire product. We start to drive to different milestones that really slow that churn down. Zero bug bounce means for some period of the last, you know, we define it differently, but of the last 24 hours, there have been no new bugs. All the bugs that we've had in the last 24 hours are all fixed. So in order to get to a zero bug bounce, you really have to have gotten rid of your entire backlog of bugs. Zero resolve bounce means all those bugs that were fixed have also been checked and verified that the fixes are working. And something like that is really causing you to kind of start to compress the amount of churn on the product. We actually internally go through a process where we control the bugs. We use something called tell mode. Tell mode means I come to you and I tell you what bugs I'm fixing. Ask mode means I come to you and I say, is it okay if I fix this bug? And you say, maybe yes, and maybe you say, no, that's not as important. So it basically gives you a valve to control. These are just the internal Microsoft terms. Again, I'm kind of talking in our language, but most teams that I know that have effective processes have some way of, again, slowing the churn and starting to control what is going to go out the door. The last thing that I didn't talk about on the slides here, but I'll just mention, is really I think effective messaging is very important. I think there comes a time at the point of the release where you want to start to have all your public communication start to be about, you know, hey, it's time to turn the corner. It's time to focus on quality, raising the bar, and kind of getting this out the door. Continuous builds. I think these are just sort of a couple of important things I'll talk briefly about. You want to always keep your builds green and working. We have, I think, like a CI build is something that will, every time you check in, make sure the build is working. Run a nightly build that builds your entire stack. And I think similarly, I'm going to skip the demo just for today because I want to get to a couple other things. Continuous testing is very important. If you have one branch, always running tests on that branch. This is just to take a look at our branches. We actually run tests at every single branch that we have. The leaf branches run tests before they check in. The parent branches will then run a set of tests every night, verifying they're in a good state. And so that enables us to do some of that rapid code merging that I talked about earlier. Oops, going backwards. All right. Number 9, continuous usage and continuous shipping. So there's a saying that I've heard, which is you get what you inspect, not what you expect. And what this means is if you're looking at the product, you're going to be finding the holes. If you're not looking at it, it's, you know, going to kind of turn into that dark kitchen sink area where it's really not what you want it to be. Some of the ways that we do this and the ways that I've seen customers do this effectively are just walkthroughs, especially walkthroughs with different executives or leaders on the project. We do this continuously internally. We'll have, for instance, Brian Harry is constantly running through scenarios in his team and across other teams. Sam does it. Other leaders in our teams do it. So they're constantly looking at the product, and if it's not working, they're just filing bugs. You get a bug from a guy like Brian Harry, who's your boss's 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 boss. You're like, oh, man, I should probably take a look at this. And it's just a way of understanding where you are at any given point in time. using the product. I'm a huge fan that there's just absolutely no substitute for using your own product if you're doing software. It's whether you're demoing it, using it every day, this is something that's been very helpful to us in Visual Studio, and especially towards the end of the last release. I know there were people externally complaining about performance. You think the external complaints were bad? You should have heard the people internally. Because you can imagine if we're driving to dog fooding at 80 or 90% of everybody in the building is using Visual Studio, and those are people who are checking in every day, if their performance is slow, those people are mad. And so it forces the issue to the top of everyone's mind. And I think that's very important. So it's very, very useful. And then the last thing I'd say is, teams that ship. So if you are on a shipping cadence, if you are used to shipping, then shipping again is no big deal. If you have not shipped for 6 years, it's sort of like, you know, going to the gym after Thanksgiving or Christmas. You know, it's a rough experience. So you want to just continually stay in shape. It's kind of the same concept as you're seeing a lot of consistent themes here. No debt, stay clean, keep shipping, talk to customers continuously. You want to continuously have a cadence which allows you to sort of exercise that shipping muscle. So the way we do that is we have a set of internal drops. Most customers that I work with, the way they'll do it is they either use demos at the end of sprints or milestones, or they'll use interim customer drops. And you want to sort of turn the whole crank. That usually people have a set of processes for shipping that are above and beyond just finishing a current milestone. And if you haven't run through those a while, like, they get kind of rusty. So you want to make sure you're doing that often. And of course, the last thing there is you want to really be pressure testing with your customers. All right, I'm going to skip examples. You guys, this is I do get so fired up on this topic that we started a little bit late, and I'm going to wrap up on time to make sure to get you guys out of here early. So I'm going to flash through just a couple of things and then make sure to get you guys off to lunch. And I have a little bit of content I'm not going to cover. If you're curious, come talk to me anytime. Obviously, I care a lot about this. So when do you use which process? I showed on the slide earlier, there's sort of a range of process options for you. One of them, actually, let me go back so I can talk a little bit about that. Range of process options. And they kind of range from more formal. And when I say formal, I mean where each piece of work that you do is signed off. There's somebody who checks and says, all right, I agree, this is right. And if you change it, you sign off again. CMMI is at that end of the spectrum. Waterfall is at that end of the spectrum. Some of you have used what we call the MPT, or the Microsoft Process Template, which is based on how Office does development, a couple of teams. That's on that end of the spectrum. And then there's sort of others that are on the other end of the spectrum, more like Scrum and Agile. They're just as Scrum is a very rigorous process. It is not at all a sort of loosey-goosey. But it is more informal in that it's much more on sort of communication, not on that written authorization. In terms of when to use which, I would say if you are in a place where you require process control and a high degree of certainty about what's going in. So industries like, again, aerospace, healthcare, I think certain parts of government industries, banking, certainly, especially with SOX compliance, you really want to be using something like CMMI. Now, CMMI is really a process framework which is about sign-off at each decision point you're making in such a way that it's trackable. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can't be using, say, iterations like Scrum or sort of feature-driven development. It does mean each decision you make and each part of your release process will be signed off, and I think that's very useful there. If you do not require those, I would certainly recommend moving down the informal end of the spectrum, because those process checks, what they're doing is they're adding additional work for you. So generally, I'd say the further left you can get, the more you want to go. Whether to use a process like Scrum or Agile, I'm not particularly religious about one over the other. I've seen teams be very successful with both. I think generally Scrum is quite useful if you like the time-boxed iterations, and for some teams that don't find that's appropriate for them, they found adopting a more loose set of Agile practices and sort of more doing feature-driven development is quite nice. Waterfall I threw in black up here because I'm going to speak to you guys frankly. I don't think it's a good process to use, and I wouldn't recommend it. It forces you to do design every single thing up front and then try and do a period of development and then do testing separately, and that's going to cause you to sort of build up so much debt and accrue it that becomes difficult to understand the release and manage change. I think there are very effective ways to be formal without being waterfall. Now, again, this is just my opinion. And the other thing I should say is Team Foundation Server, the products that we build are architected to support any process. And there are, in fact, waterfall processes on top of Team Foundation Server, and people have used them. I'm just, you know, I was asked to talk about successful project management. This wouldn't be my first choice that I recommend. So I'm going to wrap up with, I want to talk about one more thing and then get you guys off to lunch. And that is autonomous teams and central reporting. So I've talked to you guys about a bunch of practices that I think are common. I've talked a little bit about some of the different process options that you can choose, sort of generally on based on whether you're on the more formal end of the spectrum or maybe you're more informal. One of the things that we've seen internally is it can be very, very useful to allow teams to choose their own process. And I've been sort of trying to build up a library of common ideas here with you guys so that I can say now, you've seen the set of metrics we have. If you have a common set of metrics, that is fine, because you are basically saying, I'm going to let you run your team however you think is right, but we're all going to track in the same way, so we'll all have the same understanding of, you know, how much you're getting done, how you're doing on your bugs, how you're doing on your debt. And so it's fine. If you want to run a 2-week iteration or a 3-week iteration, you know, suit to your team. I think it's actually very, very useful, because some teams have different cultures, and they find it's, you know, quite valuable to be able to choose a process that fits what they're building. I think also just being able to choose how you're going to run things gives people a sense of autonomy, and that's very helpful. There are times when it's not good, and I'll tell you two times I've seen that it doesn't work well. If you're moving resources constantly back and forth between projects, so that would be like I talked to a great customer, a very, 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 very large software company, and they do a lot of moving back and forth, and for them it's not suitable because they'd have to sort of reteach people the process all the time. The other place I've seen it not work is if you're doing a lot of integration between two teams and they're on different schedules, where like very, very different processes, and also they have a different concept of what debt they finish, what they consider done. So like one team does all their testing up front, another team postpones it. This is a recipe for disaster, because those two teams, as they integrate, they tend to come in conflict over, you know, just over logistics, and that's very, very painful. So not appropriate in those two situations. Other than that, I think it works very nicely. So I'm a big fan of sort of letting people choose the right process to fit the job. And with that, I want to wrap up because I want to let you guys get off to lunch. I will be here if you have any questions. And I really appreciate you guys all coming. It's wonderful to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. And one quick thing I want to throw up on the screen before we break for lunch. I've got to switch back over to the machine here and explore. Go into a folder. There we go. Ken?
Hi.
Let me just a second.
Sure.
This is getting more elaborate here.
How old do you think I am? I have two FDA life critical implements inside my body that were built by companies using Scrum. I flew here on an Airbus, they use Scrum, and PTC, their product lifecycle management company, uses Scrum. So in those instances, we actually believe that working software tests and face-to-face communications trump inaccurate written communication any day. So I would suggest if you're interested in very precise applications, you use something precise like Scrum. Just a thought. This is my friend, the pig. In most projects, we have at the end of them something called a post-mortem, you know, where the project's over, so there's not a lot you can do, so everyone just talks. In Scrum, we have something at the end of it called a retrospective at the end of every sprint. And there we have the pigs get together and talk about how things went. And that's a fairly easy conversation because pigs are the people who are actually accountable for doing things. If you're at the end of a large project, it's hard to find anyone who's accountable because we've all mastered the art of plausible deniability. However, when you're a pig in a Scrum project, it means you're accountable for either optimizing value, managing the process, or actually doing the work in a quality way. And so we've introduced the idea of the Scrum pig. And the reason we're announcing it here is the Professional Scrum Developer Program, which teaches people how to use VS 2010 using Scrum with modern engineering practices, is the official the STS-21 2010 launch vehicle for this. And if you go to the site, you'll see more about it, as well as you'll be able to take an open assessment to see whether you have potential for being a pig or not. Now, the reason I mention this to you is scattered. You know, these are really elusive. Scattered throughout this area, very much like an Easter egg hunt, are pigs on the loose. Now, if you actually think that you have the qualifications, accountability, and strength and stamina to be a pig, you'll probably be able to see them. If you're more chicken-oriented, you'll probably be invisible to you. But if you can see it and you're really a pig, there they are. They're yours. Thank you.
Did you want to say something?
Okay. By
the way, I'll let these guys eat lunch.
Oh, goodness. There you go. There actually are some pigs out there in the wild, as he's saying, and if you find them, you can have them. Okay, let's break for lunch and be back here in about 50 minutes. Okay.